much taking a bath.
Well, Frank, remember what you told me the last time I called?
Sure, what did I say?
Good afternoon. You're listening to Living Writers on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm T. Hetzel, and today Frank is here in the studio. Frank is here in town with the Butch Closet, right now on exhibit at the Institute of Humanities, going on until October 25th. So you, if you haven't swung by already, you've got time, but don't delay. We've also got here in the studio audience, Ed is here, and we've got Jason behind the glass, and we just got to hear Team Dresch as the opening. Frank, thanks for being here, and can you say a little, like, talk a little bit about this song?
Well, good afternoon. I'm Frank with a PH and RT, your basic average all-American Jewish lesbian folk singer, and it's my pleasure to be here. The song Uncle Frank by Team Dresch is this wonderful kind of homage to, I think, having growing up and having a queer mentor. And I love that band, and the band loves me, and they inspired me to start recording again after I hadn't recorded for a very long time. So, love Team Dresch. Thank you.
Because there had been a time where you took a break and you were making art and you were making and you were working with cardboard.
Right. And that's what the Butch Closet is. It's really my memoir in paper and cardboard. And it was a wonderful opportunity when I met Amanda Krugliak at the Institute for the Humanities Gallery. We've been collaborating with Ed Diven on creating the installation for the incarnation of the Butch Closet, which opened originally in October of 2023 in Santa Monica, California, at the Craig Kroll Gallery. And this version of the show is really unique and different, and I love it. I've loved having this collaborative experience, and I hope you get to all come and visit the installation. It is literally a closet within the gallery filled with all sorts of ephemera, memorabilia, from flyers to backstage passes, and then all of my clothing and pieces made out of cardboard and illustrated and hand-sewn. And there are stories. There's a little booklet that has the images in it, and there's some stories that we'll read in a little bit that are all about why I created certain pieces, why they're meaningful to me. And so the installation is really storytelling. It's really autobiography in paper.
And it's an experience, because in Santa Monica, Frank, the objects, like all of your pieces that you'd been making for how long? Because what was the... Were the boots the first object that you made out of cardboard, or what? Because you were, one of your nomikers or so was
the cardboard cobbler.
Yes. And so was that, because you started with shoes,
did
right?
Did come from them. Yeah, I started making two-dimensional work, and then I started making three. Somebody gave me a glue gun, and I started making three-dimensional work, and it's all from found cardboard. I love cardboard. It's not special. Anybody can find it in the street and make anything from it. And the combat boots that you see around campus on the street signs and that are part of the show are made out of paper bag and cardboard. And everything's really made from found material. some of the newer pieces are made from just plain brown craft paper, which is off just a big roll of brown paper.
And those are some of the clothing items.
Yes, the jackets and shirts and bathing suits and pants and
for the surfing. For
and
the
it's
surfing
all sewn.
Part of
it. It's all sewn.
And is it using a sewing machine?
Yes, or? I learned to sew on my grandmother's, my Nana's featherweight Singer sewing machine, and I never knew how to sew. I mean, I was supposed to learn how to sew. I'm a girl, so they tried to force me to learn how to sew in middle school.
Oh, in middle school.
I failed 3 times, and I thought, you know, when would a butch ever need to know how to sew? So it wasn't until I wanted to sew, and I'd been making art for a long time then, that I learned to sew. Somebody taught me how to use the machine, and I've been off to the races ever since.
And Frank, so when you say in middle school, you know, you already felt like I am a butch, like this identity, or
well,
how, maybe
I
not
already
the
knew I shouldn't be wearing a dress, but I didn't have much of a choice.
And at that point too, like a ponytail, right? At some point, or
I had the ponytail when I was very young
with your grandfather, and
I was pretty young when I had the ponytail. Well, that ponytail could get pulled so tight. Oy.
Oh. But now, what is your haircut of choice? Because I know
I've had a flat top haircut since for the past, almost 40 years? Yeah. So, and I've had the same barber for 35 years, Albert Cornejo.
Shout out to
Santa
Albert.
Monica. Yeah. Albert's been cutting my hair for a long time. He's the one who keeps me level headed. So when I go back to LA, I'm going straight to the barbershop.
So how often do you have, because I mean, it's
long right now. Yeah, it's long and unruly, but I usually get my hair cut every 2 to 3 weeks.
So. Nice, nice.
Yeah.
And it feels like at that moment, getting your hair cut, was that around when you were 17? Was that when it happened, when you said you were going to the library, but you actually rode your bike to the women's center.
The center, yes. Yeah. And that a few weekends after that, I went to the Lesbian History Exploration, and I saw a slideshow called What the Well-Dressed Dyke Will Wear. And in it, Liza Cowan shaved her head. And I came home, and I shaved mine, and I changed my name, and I've been Frank ever since.
And when you shaved your head, was it, like, did you use, like, your
oh, I
your
went
dad's
to, I went
or your
to the
father's
barbershop.
Clippers? Oh, okay.
I went to the barbershop that was recommended. I had to go to see Bootsy at Mr. Dante's barbershop. Bootsy cut my hair.
Shout out to Bootsy.
Shout out
wherever
to Bootsy.
You are right
wherever
now.
Wherever yeah. You are. Changed my life.
Yeah. Here, who knows? Maybe in heaven. Certainly. Who knows? Hopefully still here. Yeah. I don't know why I'm sending people off before their times, right? Are these, to go back to the boots for just a second, Frank, and I also love how you have like your own catchphrase where you're like with a PH and a hard C, like just even watching you say that and how your face and your expression and you embody, like it's like this part of your identity.
They can feel it over the radio. I know you can out there, right?
Don't you think? Can't you? You can. I think you can feel you smiling in this energy through the radio waves. But these boots, are these the boots? Did Ed Ruscha buy them and lend them back to you for
yes,
the exhibit?
Yes, he did. He was very generous and lent them back to us for this show. He does not like them to leave his home. He's a very, very wonderful artist and incredibly supportive.
Because he's when you think of LA, I think
he is the LA artist, isn't he?
Well, yeah. And now for me, you are too, and musician.
Thank
so
you.
So you've got that up on him. Sorry, Ed Ruscha. But yeah, and so was this? Did he allow the boots also to be in the exhibit?
Well, yes,
the first
he loaned
exhibit
them for
too.
The exhibit.
So he's loaning it for
the exhibit. Yeah,
because the boots are critical in the story that you're telling here.
They really are my self-portrait. They're yeah. So
how so?
Well, I'm not wearing them right now.
I know you're wearing. What are you wearing?
My original boot. I'm wearing Stan Smith's right now.
Yeah,
my original. The boots are like 30 years old and they're kind of falling apart, but I love them very much. So I wear them when I perform, and I don't wear them every day anymore. So I have a new pair of boots that I'm trying to break in, but it's hard. It's heartbreaking in Boots. Everybody knows that.
It is. Yeah. It is tough. So, because you've been here, you're here for an artist residency. And
yes.
So multiple days across multiple ways people can see you and meet you. Penny Stamps lecture was that the first event, Frank?
That was the first event. Well, first I came a week and a half ago and we started the installation for the show. So we built the Butch Closet, and then we had the Penny Stamps lecture, and then we had the opening for the show. And then I've been engaging with different classes, meeting with students, you know, sharing ideas. We did a couple bow tie workshops. We've got one more bow tie workshop we're going to do tonight.
Oh, is that open to the public? Can folks
No, the
come
one
by?
Last night was the last one open to the public. But we'll post the video on how to make the paper bow tie. And so everyone will be able to make one. You'll just have to go online and watch the video.
And it's great. I can attest to it because I was lucky enough to be at the one.
Yeah, you were at the
yesterday.
One last night. Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
It was. It was a ball. And also feeling like getting lost in the making.
Yes, very important. Very important to use your hands. And for me, you know, making art is... a great practice of healing and meditation, because I get so involved in making and I don't worry about the everyday stuff. So I'm not, you know, Amanda and I have been having this discussion. Are we not thinking when we're making, or are we still thinking when we're making? I like to say I'm not thinking when I'm making. But one of the things that comes up when I'm sewing is, if you're a sewer out there, you know, it's right sides together. So when I've spent all this time painting the paper to look like fabric, and then I cut it and I sew it right sides together, I have to inside out it. So that practice is very tricky. Doesn't always work. Sometimes it tears, and, you know, I mean, that's part of making art, isn't it? It's just not everything is quote unquote successful. I mean, what's successful? What works and what doesn't work? Sometimes you run up against a lot of walls making work, but...
If there's a tear, is it something where it usually is like, then this piece, do you work the tear in and it just changes it?
Or if you look at the work that's in the show, you'll see nothing's perfect. I mean, there are tears. There's nothing's perfectly hemmed. That's not, my work is not about perfection. It's about kind of creation and inventing, and not so much... copying, it's recreating in another vein.
Which you can recognize because it's recreating in another vein. Could you say more?
Well, I'm making things that are oftentimes favorites of mine. Like I'll read a little bit about, I'll read the blue plaid coat, right? 'Cause that's... So I made this little blue plaid coat, and my mom saved some of my favorite items from childhood. And this blue plaid coat is in the show, so if you come, you will see it. It wasn't a boy's jacket or a girl's jacket. It was the supreme coat. My mother may have set my hair in a permanent wave in an effort to feminize my already too tomboy self, but she could not get me to take off my blue plaid coat. The quilted plaid felt so good hugging my small body. Little flat round brass buttons with circular grooves lined up twice to make this coat look double-breasted, but the extra row of buttons was there to make it last and grow with me. Thin threads of shiny gold were woven into the thick navy blue and white plaid cotton. It was lined with pale gray quilting. I wore it to nursery school, to the park, in the backyard, on family excursions. Like protective armor, my coat saw me through all kinds of trouble. The trouble of trying to make a kite stay in the air. The trouble of dropping a peanut butter and jelly sandwich on the back seat of the station wagon. The trouble with the teenage neighborhood boy who coerced me into playing doctor in his makeshift tent. I wore it in trouble-free times, too. This coat saw it all. I think every kid has one. A magic coat that makes them believe, if I wear this, you can't hurt me. So the plaid coat is in the show. And also another part of the show is there are home movies and there are music videos. So in the home movies, if you stand in just the right spot in the gallery, to the right you'll see like 4 yards of painted plaid paper. And then out of the corner of your left eye, you'll see the blue plaid coat on the far wall. And then the video monitor's right next to you, and I'm wearing the plaid coat in an old home movie. So it's kind of triple plaid coat.
Yes, from every angle.
Yeah.
Right?
And I love that. I love that.
I love that this coat is like, I don't know. So you literally still,
we still have
the artifact
coat.
Of
yes,
the coat.
Yes, we have the coat.
So your mom did that. Like,
yes, she did. She saved all this great stuff. She saved my lamb chop Halloween costume and my blue plaid coat and my baby quilt. And you can pick up this small little booklet, this little catalog, Frank the Butch Closet, if you swing by the Institute for the Humanities Gallery, and some of the pieces are written in here, and there's these beautiful Stephanie Harrell and Annika, say Annika's name wrong, Annika Smits put together this wonderful little booklet, and I'm just absolutely thrilled.
With photos from home.
Yeah. There's all kinds of little special pictures and the family pictures in the back too. Yeah.
Really wonderful.
Yeah.
Because you're even on a skateboard in one. Mm-hmm. This is maybe one of my favorites.
Yeah.
We're going to take a short break and then we'll be back today on Living Writers. Frank is here. The Butch Closet. I'm T. Hetzel. We'll be back. Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, I'm so glad you did. Today on the program, Frank is here, The Butch Closet, and also Frank's albums. Frank, let's talk about the 64.
Well, it's not crazy for a girl to love her car.
It is not.
No, it's not. I have a 1964 Falcon station wagon that I love, and that's what that song's about. And what I love is that coming into the radio station, we were talking about college radio. I love being here. It reminds me of when my records came out, I would go to all the college radio stations and meet the DJs, and we'd give out promotional copies of the record. And college radio is really why I have a music career, because college radio was the only radio that played anything alternative. And thank you, college radio, for still being here. But what I really love is...
Well, and then these are the records that you're talking about that people from the time when they came out, when they were sent, we've even got, like, this is one you hadn't seen, right, Frank? Because it's a test pressing.
It's a test pressing of 64 Ford. And what I love is on the album covers, there are these little stickers that have reviews that were written. And this record, 64 Ford, has this review. Disappointing. Frank is on her way to selling out. which I just love.
Wait, what else? Are there other highlights? Are you, yeah.
Is this the one where it's like, listen for yourself
or whatever?
It's poppy, it's overproduced, and it's basically terrible. And it says, so I could be wrong, but listen for yourself. But my descriptive word is awful. I just love that. And that's
what we just heard, everybody, just so that you're in on it, too.
It's just awful.
It's so awful.
Some of the other reviews I've given are a little...
Oh, and what... You're holding up an album now.
It's called I Enjoy Being a Girl.
And what year is this?
This came out in 1991.
So this is one of the iconic photos, I'd say, of you. Like, it's you and your red turtleneck.
With a glass of milk.
Very
wholesome.
And then on the flip side of the album, it's young you.
Yes, that's me. This is the picture that I think we opened the stamps lecture with. Me as like a 3-year-old, as a cute little girl.
And it's definitely, you've gone to like the Sears portrait studio or somewhere to get a portrait
done. I think my mom had that picture taken. Also, the cover photo was taken by Rocky Shank, who's a wonderful photographer.
And it feels like a, I can see why you toured with the Smiths.
This was the record that was out. Actually, no, Folk Singer was out when I toured with the Smiths. That was in like 1986. When I toured with Morrissey, that was in 1991. That was Positively Frank. But the record, the song that's on this album, even though this was my second record, my first record was called Folk Singer. But the way I became a solo musician again, after being in the bands Nervous Gender and Catholic Discipline, was the punk community in Los Angeles was really familial. It was, we all hung out together. It was a bunch of misfits, and we all made music, and none of us fit in, so we all fit together. And then the scene got very, instead of being like a family, it started to get a little aggro, and people started wearing swastikas, and so I wrote the song Take Off Your Swastika, and then I started performing on an acoustic guitar so that you could hear the words. And I was still playing in punk venues, and all my friends were still in bands, but I just chose to play solo so that you could hear the words to take off your swastika.
Because in Nervous Gender, like, it's the music, like, there's still lyrics. Like, there's still...
But it was a synthesizer band and very, very loud.
And that's the thing. It's like, it's the experience of, like, the feeling or the emotion, right?
That yeah, the there music were great lyrics don't get me wrong.
Were you writing the lyrics for these other...
No, Nervous Gender, I did not write lyrics, and I did not write lyrics in Catholic Discipline either. I was a guitar player in Catholic Discipline, and I sang basically Gerardo's lyrics in Nervous Gender, and I tried to play the synthesizer a little bit. it was all new to me. So
you also, is this when you started writing then, Frank? Was when you wrote Take Off That Swastika, like the song?
I've been writing for a long time, but that's when I wrote that song, and that song is what transitioned to me to playing solo.
So, yeah. But let's talk about your writing. So what were you writing, and was it... Like, was it all along? Were you a kid that wrote stuff down as well as
skateboarded? Yes, I wrote stuff down. I would go across to my friend Dante's house. Her dad had like a cassette deck in the bare bedroom, and I would pretend I was having a concert, and she would introduce me. And, you know, it was my fantasy to be a musician.
So it was always around music and about performing.
Yes, and always drawing, too, and always making art. So I was always doing both, so... And don't let anybody tell you could have to do one thing. You can do everything that you want to do. Yeah.
Yeah. And so for you, when you are writing a song, is it chords, or is it the music, the composition that comes to you, or is it lyrics?
That's a popular question. Do you write the words or the music first? It just depends. Sometimes it all comes out at once. Sometimes I play a piece of music for a long time before I have words for it, and sometimes it comes out in one big lump.
So for Take Off Your Swastika,
it came out in one big lump.
Yeah, because that feels like that. Yeah. No wonder that was like this moment of epiphany and.
Well, it was also when I started coming out on stage and introducing myself as a Jewish lesbian folk singer, because I feel like, you know, Jews and lesbians pretty invisible, and I needed to identify. But that's become my introduction, it's also the greatest icebreaker in the world, because when I walk out on stage and introduce myself and come out that way, people laugh. You know, it's got, I mean, it's a lot. I mean, and once you get somebody to laugh and you open them up just that little bit where you can really talk about anything. So,
and some of your songs are, well, I guess what we just heard with the Falcon, the station wagon, that was like fun and upbeat and loving, right? But some of your songs are very, like, obviously serious.
Well, we can play a little bit of Take Off Your Swastika.
We're getting there. But it's so interesting to hear you talk about, like, the process of making a song, thinking of it as, is it similar to your process of making where, because you said earlier you and Amanda were talking and you're not thinking when you're working making. With the making.
Making and but, thinking.
But how is it with music? Or is it just
well,
totally...
Well, my music and my art both do the same thing. They tell story. Right. And so what I'm trying to do in The Butch Closet is I'm really trying to bring together in my autobiography my music and my art. And at this point, it's the videos that are in the room, the music videos that are background to the artwork that's in the closet and on the walls. What I am envisioning in the future is that music will be part of the exhibition, where perhaps you'd walk in front of the blue plaid coat and a song would play, or the story would play. So there'll be an audio component embedded in the show. So that's my goal, because this is a... It's autobiographical, and I intend to expand and tour the show, hopefully worldwide, so that especially young queers can experience all the content in The Butch Closet.
And that's been something, when you say, like, especially young queers, that's always been a value to connect and be yourself. That's why when at 17... that's a relatively, like, it's a young age, you were able to have the strength or the stubbornness or some combination of just the knowing, like the certainty that I'm going to be myself. And if I can't be myself here at home, I will go on my own.
Well, I found my people. Yeah. I went to find my people. And I think, you know, community is the reason why I'm here. Community is but what's supported me. I found a women's community. I found an art community.
Community.
I found a music community. I have a punk community. I have a surfing community. I have a swimming community. You know, and I think, you know, when you're surrounded by community, you hold each other up. And community has basically saved me, you know. And when I was very young, they really, you know, people took care of me and really supported me and nourished me as a young artist and a musician. And when I was at the Feminist Studio Workshop at the Woman's Building in the mid-70s, that was a really special time. You know, that was the cutting edge of the feminist art movement. That was a community that I don't know if it ever existed before that. And that's where I grew up. So how lucky am I? And so that I came to punk rock with a feminist foundation that, you know, I grew up there. I already had my identity. I was already out as a lesbian. I was already frank. I was already me. And then I went to this other world, and I had that, you know, I had that strength.
And what is it like? Like, I can imagine that it would feel strong to name yourself.
Well, I think that when we take a hold of our own identities, it is very empowering. I think, you know, when a lot of queer people come out, they do, you know, we do these transitions of cutting our hair, changing our clothes, perhaps changing our names, just trying to be our authentic selves. And sometimes that means shedding a lot of the stuff that we grew up with and all of the things that were put on us and all of the expectations, and letting go of all of those and claiming the people that we want to be. And that's what The Butch Closet is, really. It's really about identity. It's about becoming who you are. And I talk about the closet. It's not a place to hide in. It's a place to get ready. It's a place to keep special things. It's a place of safety and a place of growth.
And there are pieces inside the closet. There's like pieces. It's not all like, it's not whole cloth. There's different.
Everything's made out of paper or cardboard.
No. What I mean is, sorry, Frank, but it's not like that. It's not something that maybe happens all at once. Like you're discovering things as you go, and there are these different discrete pieces of things that, and now you can see them in relation to each other, and how you're building these exhibits, and each one maybe will be different. Like you said, the next one will have this different audio component. This one is like, won't ever be the same because of the angles that you described right. for the blue plaid coat and the like, you know. Yeah.
And it's very different from the first version, but you know, it's kind of cool that it gets to,
because it's
evolved
because
in
it's
this
becoming
way.
Too. Like
yes,
you just said,
it's becoming
like
yeah.
a self. So yeah. it's the same. Let's take a short break. And what we're going into right now is Take Off Your Swastika. What was it like? Where did you sing it first?
I think I sang it first at Club 88 in West LA.
Here we go.
Swastika, it's making me angry. Take off your swastika, it really nauseates me. You see, Frank, it's just a symbol, it's just an emblem, it's just a righteous decoration. What it means, a little more to me. Fascism isn't anarchy. Fascism isn't anarchy. Fascism is not anarchy. Sure, I've got Jewish damage. What the hell do you expect? 13 years at Hebrew school, and all the slides that they project. Of all the burning bodies, of all the concentration camps. All the concerts that I go to, and how many TV shows.
Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, you're just in time. Today on Living Writers, Frank is here in the studio. The Butch Closet, the current multimedia memoir on exhibit at the Institute of Humanities Gallery. Frank, thanks for singing that song, because I feel like it's even more even as necessary now as when you were first, when you first created it, and when you first took the step out on stage solo with your guitar to sing your own lyrics.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, that song doesn't go out of style. Maybe one day it will.
Yeah.
Yeah, I hope so.
Yeah. So before we go any further, mm-hmm. I want to say, what a beautiful voice you have. You probably hear that all the time, but what you can do with it, you know, because when you think of someone coming through like LA's punk movement, you don't necessarily first think of like a voice that's so full and rich
and ladylike.
Well, I don't know if it's. Well, I wouldn't have said that. That's you. That's you saying that. Let's on record.
Yeah, they look at me, and then that voice comes out. Ooh, what's going on?
Wait, do you like that? Like, is that like? Do you?
I can't help it. It's just what I sound like. But yeah, it's people are surprised often.
But I actually feel like you could help it. Like, you could shout, you could scream, you could scratch out
that.
Your voice.
I've done that. Did you hear me? When I was in the band Nervous Gender, I screamed quite a bit. And at the Stamps lecture, I played a little clip of a song that I sang in Nervous Gender called Mommy's Chest. And you can hear me just screaming it. My mommy's chest! My mommy's chest!
Yeah. Yeah, so what is, let's talk a little bit about your performance. Like, because part of what you're going to be doing now is the multimedia memoir, The Butch
Frank
Closet.
Talk. It's Frank Talk, The Butch Closet. And Frank Talk is the performative part of the piece where I tell stories, I show pictures and videos, and I sing songs. So I tell my story through pictures and songs and videos. Then you come to the Butch Closet, and that is the physical embodiment of the storytelling. So the two work together. They're companion pieces. I feel like they both could stand alone, but they're most effective when they're together. So my hope is to tour them both as performance and exhibition.
What do you value about performance? Is it the intimacy of being in a space with others versus like sending out like a documentary is awesome. Like we'll talk about maybe the Tupperware Lady in a moment or two, but.
Oh, right.
Tupperware right. Lady. We can't forget that. Right. I'm going to start singing, humming it again.
We can't forget the Tupperware. No.
but like something about being in the space.
It's different. Singing and performing is very different because you know, right away if people like it or not. And when you have an exhibition, you're not necessarily present when people are viewing the work, so you don't really know how they're reacting to it. So it's very different in that way.
Yeah, because you're not guiding it. Well, you're guiding it in how it's created and placed.
Well, you kind of get the feedback, and you get the feedback right away if you're performing, but you don't get the feedback right away if it's an installation. But they're both very valuable. I mean, it's like private space and public space. I mean, when I see art, it's a very private kind of personal experience. Maybe even if I'm seeing it in a huge gallery or a museum with other people, I'm having my personal feelings about the work.
Yeah, each person brings their own stories in to see with your story.
Yeah, but when you perform and you go see a band play or a concert, you have reactions too, but your reaction is maybe out loud and with a bunch of other people, and it's much more of a public kind of expression. So they're both different. What's the same is they tell stories, and what's the same is I make them alone and then I share them.
And it feels like the performance part, Frank Talk, mm-hmm. is important in because of part of your mission.
I can connect. I get to come out on stage. I get to really have an experience with an audience. I get to sing and share images in a way that, you know, personally, instead of just putting them up on the screen. So,
and it seems, I think it's no accident how you phrase this. I can come out on stage. Mm-hmm. You say this. This is the mission.
Yes, I always
because
do.
Each. Yeah. Do you want to?
No, I always come out on stage. I always literally come out on stage.
I mean, it works in a couple of different ways,
yeah,
doesn't
it? Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. But it's interesting, like that words matter to you, where you are thinking I'm going to come out on stage, because each time it could be to a different audience and it could mean different things.
It's important for me to come out as a queer on stage every time I step on stage, because I don't know who's going to be in the audience and need to see me. Now, there might be somebody that feels very alone and still feels like they're the only one, and maybe I'm the only representation that they're going to see on stage. So people were there for me when I came out, and like I said, there was a community for me. There were artists and musicians that were out and were a great influence on me.
Maybe we could hear Amazons now.
Oh, sure.
Does that sound good? Jason,
yeah.
Do you have Amazons there? You've got Living Writers. We're going to just take a short break because now we're going to hear Frank's song, Amazons. Do you want to intro it at all, Frank? Or is that
no. Just play Amazons, and I'll sing you a new version of the first verse when we get off.
Okay. Oh, give me a pair of pectorals like Diana Nyad. I want to swim 89 miles.
Give me a set of deltoids like Tracy Hawkins. I wanna be strong like those Amazons. I wanna learn to dribble like Annie Myers. I wanna learn to shoot like Cheryl Miller. I wanted to play for the Dallas Diamonds and live with Martina like Nancy Lieberman. Strong, strong. Strong, strong, like an Amazon.
Strong, strong, like an Amazon. It's all about these fantastic women athletes, and I'm slowly working to update it. So now I start it by saying, give me a pair of pectorals like Diana Nyhat. I want to swim 89 miles. Give me a set of deltoids like Katie Ledecky. I want to be strong like those Amazons. So I'm slowly updating. I want to learn to dribble like Brittany Griner. I want to learn to shoot like Caitlin Clark. You know, like, so I'm updating Amazons because there are so many Amazons in the world today that are so fantastic. In fact, I was walking by this bookstore. What's it called? The Third Mind? Is that the bookstore? There's a bookstore in town here in Ann Arbor, and I found this book on the $1 shelf, The Last Amazon. I had to get it. So
and $1.
It was really good. It's $1. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. It's very, that's so great.
Very, yeah.
Have you been to Don Treader too?
Not yet.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
And Literati?
Well, maybe it was Don Treader. Maybe it was, that's where it was.
A $1 yeah, bookshelf yeah. sounds yeah. more like,
you're
yes.
right. That's oh, what it no. was.
Well, not that I want to be right. I'm not trying to be.
Well, no, but if you want to find some good books, go there.
Yeah,
it's
Don
really
Treader.
Good.
Yeah,
really
such a good. Treasure. Well, so Frank, would you mind reading from Frank the Butch Closet?
Yeah, I'll read from the little booklet, and this is a piece that's about my brother, and it's about his blue bathrobe. And the reason my brother's included in this show is he's a big part of the reason I returned to making visual art. My music career was really zooming quite along, you know, and I was out on the road with Morrissey, and Positively Frank had come out on Island Records, and things were great, and I was getting ready to go perform, and I got a phone call that my brother had been killed. So I came home, and I stopped everything, and I did not want to perform or be in front of anyone, and I went into the studio, and I started making art, started making paper art. And so he's a huge reason on how I returned back to making. And then slowly I got back to performing again. And but he's included in this show in many ways. There's this piece, The Blue Bathrobe. And then there's, if you pick up the catalog, there's a little picture of him in the back of the book. And anyway, I love and miss my brother Gary, and this is Blue Bathrobe. My younger brother Gary's blue corduroy bathrobe was tailored and handsome, like nothing I would be allowed to wear. I was stuck in Flowered Lands flannel, and he was in Tom and Jerry corduroy. I'd sneak into my brother's bedroom and raid his closet, and even though I knew his clothes wouldn't fit, I tried on his striped cotton t-shirts, Madras button-downs, and Sears denim tough skins. His small jockey shorts, white as marshmallows, lay neatly folded in his underwear drawer. I also tried to squeeze into his gray wool Little League uniform. I coveted all his clothes. I wished they could be mine. I loved his bathrobe so much, I still have it, as bright blue as the day it was bought. It's still soft, and it still does not fit me. It is my talisman of a lost brother in his boyhood. The pockets are deep enough for your whole hand. Nightgowns have no pockets. They are just the pajama version of a dress. I had a girl's fluffy bathrobe, but for me it held no swagger. I can still see him in that bathrobe, sneaking down the hallway towards my room after our parents were asleep, or at the breakfast table, sipping his orange juice, wrapped in blue corduroy.
Hey, Frank. Thanks for choosing that one to read.
Where do we go from there?
I feel like the part that you with the blue bathrobe, I loved hearing about how you use making as a way to heal, but also to find a way back being yourself after such a, like, it's something so such a loss.
So people use art to heal from grief a lot. I mean, it is a very effective way to move through feelings, I think. And having the time to be alone and make did just that for me. And the thing that's kind of funny is all of the work that I made was very bright and funny. And I'm coming from a very sad place, but I think the first piece that I made, I painted a pair of boxer shorts, and then somebody gave me a glue gun, and the first piece I made was a big piece of cake. I made a big piece of cake, and then I made pumpkins, and I made a cherry pie.
I love the cherry pie, how there's only one slice of the pie in the bottom of the closet.
I made the That's can of Crisco. I made the leather jacket. I started making all these pieces that were really, really fun. And it wasn't, you know, I wasn't miserable. I was just sad, but all this joy kind of came out. So it's really, really... It's kind of magical in a way, what art can do. Yeah.
And surprising, not what you expected.
Very surprising.
But it got you down the street to this studio that you also changed. Like I think you talked about community earlier, Frank, because that is such a part of like who you are and the stories you tell. But someone reached out and said, we have this space, do you want it?
Oh, they shared the studio with me at 18th Street Arts Complex in Santa Monica. Yes, they gave me a space to make art.
And you remade the space immediately as part of, well, you knew something about what you wanted to do in the space.
Yeah, and then I was making art in a community of other artists, which is very exciting. And I think students can relate to this. If you're a student and you have a studio and you're next to other students and you're all making art, there's nothing greater than making a piece and being able to just run outside and say, knock on the person next door and say, look, what do you think? You know, it's very cool. I love that. I love that about being in an art community, that you can share your work and share your excitement and still have that private time to make the work. But artist communities are really wonderful in that way.
And do you still have the studio, or what is it like now?
Another studio now. I've had a couple of different studios, and I still work pretty much alone. I work in a place it's more like an office building where I have a space, so it's not other artists next to me. But I've learned to have, you know, studio visits and share space, have other artists come over and see, and I go over to their studios and see what they're working on. So, and then I live in Vancouver, Canada, half the time, and I have a whole art community up there, and I have people that I make jelly prints with. My friend Valerie and Carlin, every Monday, I make prints with them.
What's a jelly print?
It's this kind of rubbery slab, and you just kind of can make a pattern on it and put your paper down, and it's like an instant way to print. It's a really, really fun, quick, instant way to print. Yeah, so that's really fun.
And you, because you've got a history of printing.
Yes, I come
like from
a
way back.
Yes, silk screening and offset printing. But this is, you don't need to know how to print to do this. This is very, and it's very instant. And also it's a surprise because you don't know what you're going to get. And speaking of surprises, the bow tie workshop, weren't you surprised? Because everybody's drawing on a piece of paper and you can draw anything you want. But then when you fold it up,
it's different yet again.
It becomes something else. Yeah. So it's kind of the nice surprise. You never really know. I mean, I never really know what's going to happen. I know what I kind of want to happen, and I have a vision, but all kinds of things happen when you're making art. And sometimes the best art you make turns out completely different from what you thought it might be.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And
exciting.
And that you like let it be like that.
Yeah.
Not try to strong arm something, like go with what it is.
Well, I don't think you can make it. Yeah. I don't think you can make anything be that something that it's not supposed to be. That's right, right? You can you can't make a person be something they're not supposed to be either. So
that's like I feel like Frank, thank you for being who you are and also having the strength to be telling the story of who you are and encouraging other people to feel that energy, that spirit, because it takes a wellspring of your own to keep, to share, to give that energy to others. And I sense that folks try to probably give energy to you, but in the way of performing, and it's a lot that's coming outward. So thank you.
Yeah, and then I get it back too. So,
you do, yeah.
So thank you. But you know, a big shout out to the queer community, the LGBTQIA, two-spirit, trans community. You know, it's never too late to come out and be who you are.
It is.
Ever.
Right.
So, yeah.
Ever. How did pickles come into the picture?
Pickles. We're going to go there.
Do you mind? I would love to.
No. Pickles is my parrot. She's 31 years old. Yes. I've been with my partner, Lisa, for 28 years, but I've been with Pickles for 31.
And so Pickles is like, don't you forget it.
Two wives. And she's wonderful. She's basically written all the songs. I really can't take credit. It's all Pickles. Really, it is.
Well, there was a journalist trying to interview for the Women of Rock history, right?
Oh, and Tanya Pearson, when she was doing the Women of Rock interviews. Yeah, yes. That are wonderful. They're on the Smith College website. I think it's womenofrock.org. And she interviewed all these underrecognized women musicians. And you can go there and watch hour-long interviews with really fantastic women musicians.
Yeah, it's audio and video.
Yes.
So you get to actually watch it and
yes.
You get to see some cameos of Pickles, but Pickles is as an audio...
Pickles is a star.
As an audio presence, right?
Pickles is present in many ways, yes.
Well, okay. It pains me to kind of move away from Pickles, so maybe we could come back. But
sure.
I did want to do also a quick shout out of note to the documentary that was just shown.
Lifetime Guarantee,
State.
Frank's Adventures in Plastic, a documentary film by Lisa Udelson, who is an alumna of UMichigan, and she was just here for the screening of the film, which came out in 2001, so it's over 20 years old, but it was a documentary about my first year selling Tupperware.
And what a documentary it is.
It's pretty great. She did a great job. So.
And it's been remastered, so maybe there'll be a release date.
We're hoping.
More
we don't
widely.
Know where it's going to go next. It was part of Jenny Olson, who's a great queer filmmaker and film scholar, put it together in a series called Mask, which was all about Butch and Mask artists. And it was on the Criterion Channel as part of this collection. It's not up there right now, but we don't know where it's going to go next. So it could go streaming. It could be theatrical. We don't know. But anyway, it's out in the world now. It is available. It is accessible. I wouldn't say available, but it's exciting that it's now in the world.
So. What was it like to watch it on Sunday? Because you were at the screening there at the State Theater.
Yeah, for me, it's like watching a home movie.
Yes.
Yes, it's really fun to watch. And Lisa was sitting next to me and we made this film. And she made the film really by herself. She had a small handheld video camera and she followed me everywhere I went. To the Tupperware conventions, to Tupperware parties. And
how did you know to trust her with this? Because it was your first year. Like, you were at the cusp of starting something, too.
We just clicked. She She was a girlfriend of a friend of mine who came to my very first Tupperware party. And once she heard the word Tupperware, she said, there's a film in this. And she says, I want to film it. And I said, okay. And then we were just kind of off we went.
And you slayed Tupperware. You were like,
I love Tupperware. I'm a Tupperware lady. Yeah. You know, I got to do a lot of things with Tupperware, and I was just starting, we were just starting our family then. My daughter was 3 years old. I didn't want to go on the road and do music. I needed a job, and Tupperware was perfect for me at the time. So
the life of an artist, you know, you yes. see what comes.
We do everything we need to do so that we can make the things we want to make. So, you know, nothing's going to stand in the way of me making my art. Sometimes I can support myself from my music and my art, and other times I need to take other jobs to support myself to make my music and art, but I am always going to make my music and art.
Frank, you are wonderful. You're a new hero, let me tell you. Is it okay to say you're an Amazon?
Oh, wow, what a compliment. Thanks, T.
Anytime. Today on the program, Frank has been here in the studio, the Butch Closet. You can go and see it now at the Institute of Humanities.
Yes, perhaps we should end with Bulldagger Swagger.
I think.
What a great affirmation.
Yeah.
And swagger on over to the Institute of Humanities Gallery and check out Frank Doc, the Butch Closet.
Keep on swaggering. Thanks for listening, everyone.
Thanks, T. Thanks, Jason. Thanks, Ed.
Thanks, Frank.
Awesome. Beautiful.
To every young man who can't pass, from every lipstick, lazy lass, from every drag queen's high-heeled stagger, to every bulldagger swagger, do the bulldagger swagger, do the bulldagger swagger, do the bulldagger swagger, yeah. I went to charm school, I got a degree in full-fledged femininity. Not trying to be a man, I'm just a being who I am, and that's a very, very, very butch, a lesbian. Do the bulldagger swagger, do the bulldagger swagger, do the bulldagger swagger, yeah. Little girl giggled, a lady gasped, one woman almost had a heart attack. She started doing the bulldagger swagger, do the bulldagger swagger, do the bulldagger swagger, yeah, yeah. To every young man who every lipstick, lazy lass, from every drag queen's high-heeled stagger, to every bulldagger swagger, do the bulldagger swagger, do the bulldagger swagger, do the bulldagger swagger.
This is Ocean Vuong.
I'm Jane Smiley.
My name is Arundhati Roy.
Wednesdays at 5, join me, T. Hetzel, for Living Writers. Each week, we spend an hour in conversation with authors from Michigan and around the world. Poets, journalists, novelists, and children's book authors share their personal stories, read from their work, and give us insights into the process of writing and publishing, and sometimes surprise us.
I have to confess to something now on your welcoming channel.
Tune in every Wednesday at 5 p.m. for Living Writers, right here on WCBN-FM Ann Arbor.
Welcome to another episode of the Daily Sports Report here on WCBN-FM Ann Arbor. For this Wednesday night edition of the show, I'm Zachary Linder along with Theo Chernoff, Perry Mortzinos, and Rob Doyle. And today, gonna get into a bit of the MLB playoff picture, obviously sitting at less than 2 weeks left in this regular season. Postseason rapidly approaching here, and we do have a few interesting playoff pictures. A lot going on in the NL wild card race. Still looking to see if the Tigers maybe can make a push for that final wild card spot in the AL. Division races at this point, none look that interesting. I think according to Fangraphs, every current division leader has at least a 90% chance of winning the division. Closest race right now is the Dodgers sitting at 3.5 over the Padres. Those teams do play three more times in Los Angeles before the season ends. Maybe we have something going on there. Brewers have clinched the division today with the Cubs 5-3 loss to the Yays. Once again, listening to WCBN-FM Ann Arbor. And guys, just to kind of start, what's most interesting to you in this playoff picture here in these final 2 weeks?
I think both wild card pictures are in similar spots. The Tigers against the Twins, they're trying to catch the Twins and maybe the Royals, considering the Tigers play the Royals tonight, I believe. And in the NL, the Braves and the Mets. The Braves do play the Mets three more times, so they have a chance to make up ground directly head-to-head. But I think the wild card is about all that's interesting, other than clinching seeding in the first round, getting those